Ansarullah movement says it's hit an important target at Saudi Arabia's Abha airport in retaliation for Saudi airstrikes in Yemen. A gas tanker explosion at a customs post in Afghanistan injures at least 10 people. And riot police in Chile's capital, Santiago, clash with anti-government protesters using water cannons and tear gas. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Yemeni Ansarullah forces say they have hit an important target at the Abha airport in Saudi Arabia's southwestern province of Aser. The Ansarullah military spokesman says the attack is in response to the Saudi-led coalition airstrikes in the Arab country. No further information has been provided. Saudi Arabia earlier said it had intercepted a drone targeting the airport. Riyadh launched its aggression against Yemen in March of 2015. Since then, tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, have been killed and many others displaced. The United Nations has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. UN aid agencies have warned that 2.3 million children under the age of five are estimated to be suffering from malnutrition. They've sounded the alarm that 400,000 of them could die if Yemen does not receive urgent aid. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, brings us more.
2.3 million children under the age of five are estimated to be suffering from acute malnutrition, including 400,000 who could starve to death if they don't receive urgent treatment and humanitarian aid, according to four UN agencies.
We always hear that there are huge numbers regarding human suffering, but the problem is that we do not see any measures to address this issue. And there are great risks regarding children's health care. I think that the numbers are greater than those mentioned in the United Nations reports. We appeal to the donors to take measures that limit children's suffering mainly.
22% is the increased rate of acute malnutrition from last year's figures, which is the highest level recorded since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015. The UN agency said a lack of funds was hampering humanitarian programs in Yemen, urging donor nations to commit to their obligations.
The United Nations has been talking about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen for 5 years, especially children, but it's only rhetoric. There is a clear reduction in the aid provided to children and women, so we believe that the United Nations aims through these statements to obtain more funding by the suffering of Yemenis.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the impoverished country some 6 years ago.
Despite the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the country, some believe that the UN agency's reports are aimed at pushing more countries to donate and fulfill their programs rather than saving the lives of the Yemeni children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Meanwhile, European lawmakers say the bloc is responsible for the suffering of millions in Yemen through its arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They passed a resolution calling on all parties to facilitate the rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief to the Yemeni population. Jerome Hughes brings us more.
EU lawmakers are not allowed to show images in Parliament, but one MEP broke this rule to illustrate the unthinkable suffering being endured by starving children in Yemen. The hearing was told that warplanes manufactured in the EU have been dropping Italian-made bombs on Yemen, including hospitals.
And French DCI company is at the moment training Saudi soldiers on how to better launch rockets into Yemen.
24 million people in Yemen are suffering. 50,000 are living in famine-like conditions.
US President Biden has recently announced the suspension of arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. we in the EU should ban sales of arms or any military equipment to the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the Saudi regime and its partners launched their war on Yemen in 2015, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed.
The Saudi-led coalition went to war to stop the prospects of peace, power sharing and independence in Yemen. With Western help,
just in the three-year period from 2015 to 2018, campaigners highlight how the EU sold arms to Saudi Arabia valued at €2 billion, while humanitarian aid to the country from the EU is less than €1 billion during the entire 6 years of conflict.
Stop arming Saudi Arabia because they are using these weapons to kill the civilians and to make a war crimes in Yemen. You know, regarding the United Nations, Yemen now it is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
Even the European Union's top diplomat admits shortcomings.
Yes, the humanitarian and political situation in Yemen deserves more attention. Much more than the one we pay to it.
Lawmakers have just passed a resolution condemning the violence while calling for a greater EU response. Similar resolutions have been passed by the European Parliament before, but ultimately they are ignored when EU leaders meet here at the European Council. The reason for that, according to anti-war campaigners, there is simply too much money at stake. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Former European Central Bank Chief Mario Draghi is sworn in as Italy's new prime minister. The swearing-in ceremony of the 73-year-old economist was held in the presidential palace in Rome. Draghi has a cabinet comprising of a broad base of political parties and technocrats. His government faces a confidence vote next week. His predecessor, Giuseppe Conte, stepped down in January after his party lost support for his coalition government due to plans for spending EU recovery money. Italy faces numerous challenges. Now the country has been mired in its worst economic downturn since World War II. It is also grappling with the coronavirus pandemic, which is still claiming hundreds of lives every day. And now to Afghanistan, where a gas tanker has exploded at a customs post in the western part of the country near the Iranian border, injuring at least 10 people. The incident occurred in the border town of Islamgala in Herat province. Officials in Iran and Afghanistan say the blast sparked a massive fire that quickly spread to nearby fuel tankers, causing more explosions. It is not clear what caused the blast. Now, Afghan health officials say the number of casualties could rise. Herat's provincial governor says that Afghanistan has asked for Iran's urgent assistance to contain the blast. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman says his country has kept the Dagharun Islamgala border open for those who have escaped the fire. He noted that Tehran has taken the necessary measures to help those who have been affected by the incident. Meanwhile, at least four security personnel have been killed and 10 others, including civilians, injured in a string of blasts in southern and eastern Afghanistan. Police say four security forces, including a commander, were killed after an explosion in the Chapadar district of eastern Konar province took place. Separately, an explosive-laden vehicle ripped through a police outpost in Kandahar province, injuring seven personnel. And a roadside blast injured three civilians in eastern Nangarhar province. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Afghanistan has witnessed a rise in such assaults in recent days, with the government mostly blaming them on the Taliban. Violence surges despite ongoing talks between the militant group and the government to bring a lasting peace to the war-battered country. Moving on to other news this hour, turning now to South America, where protests in Chile have turned violent as riot police clash with rioters protesting against police brutality in Santiago. Police in riot gear used water cannons and tear gas to disperse the crowd. Protesters were seen throwing rocks at security forces and attacking armored vehicles. These are the latest in a series of protests that intensified after the police's killing of a street artist in a lakeside resort. Security forces have been in the spotlight of intense scrutiny during months of protests against social injustice. International human rights groups accuse police of human rights violations and using excessive force. Chileans have been gathering each week to protest stark inequality in the country since 2019. Well, a UN expert has called on the U.S. and the European Union to ease their sanctions on Venezuela, saying the measures have worsened the humanitarian situation in the country. We discuss it with our guests.
Hello, welcome to the News Review. The UN envoy calls on the U.S. and the European Union to ease their sanctions on Venezuela, saying the measures have worsened the humanitarian situation in the country.
The economy's decline started in 2014 with the downturn in oil prices. Among other factors reported to affect the economy of Venezuela, unilateral sanctions increasingly imposed by the United States, the European Union, and other countries have exacerbated the above-mentioned challenges.
Duhan said the unilateral sanctions have had devastating effects on the basic human rights of Venezuelans, including the right to food, health, life, and education. She said the sanctions mainly affect those in extreme poverty. She called existing humanitarian exceptions for Venezuela ineffective and insufficient. The UN envoy made the comments following a 12-day visit to the South American country. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro hailed the UN move and called the sanctions coercive.
Today, the rapporteur of the UN has called on the U.S. government and the governments of the European Union to review the sanctions and lift the sanctions against Venezuela because they have exacerbated this gigantic, enormous humanitarian crisis against the people.
Opposition leader Juan Guaido's UN envoy, on the other hand, criticized Duhan's remarks as imprecise and a propaganda tool. The UN had previously called on Washington to lift its sanctions on Venezuela during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. ambassador to Caracas, however, claims the economic crisis in Venezuela is due to its government's corruption. Duarte Coleman is an author and journalist joining us from Paris, and we also have Angelo Giuliano, who's a political analyst joining us from Antwerp. Welcome. Duarte Coleman, let me first come to you. Venezuela's economy, obviously, is battered on multiple fronts, but one of the main areas of its suffering, the way it is, in which the humanitarian situation falls under that, are the sanctions that have been imposed by the U.S. And as a result, deaths are occurring and people are having a very hard time when it comes to just medicinal supplies overall. Can anything be done? Even this U.N. call by this envoy, is it going to get listened to, or is the status quo going to continue?
It's very difficult to get the United States and the European Union to lift sanctions. I mean, it is possible. Countries have managed to get sanctions eased in the past, but it takes an awful lot of pressure. And I don't see any reason why they would lift sanctions. The sanctions are basically a form of economic warfare, which the purpose of which is to basically make the government there cow down to European and American geopolitical and economic interests, and to give them a foothold in that region of the world. The whole reason for the sanctions in the first place is not because the government is corrupt or has stolen elections. It is because the government is simply not following the rule book laid down by Brussels and Washington. And that is the whole reason for, it's one of the major reasons in any case for the humanitarian crisis in the country. Venezuela has been forced to be more creative in its foreign policies because of the sanctions. And so, for example, we've seen an emerging geopolitical alliance with Turkey, where the Turks are exporting a lot of essential supplies to the country. And they're getting a lot of their medical supplies from other countries like Turkey. They've had to increase ties with Russia, China, Iran, and other countries because of U.S. aggression. It's a very stupid policy from a U.S. point of view also, because they could have, if they had lifted the sanctions, they could have opened and normalized diplomatic relations with Caracas, and it would be better for everyone. But instead, they've decided to pursue this aggressive policy, which they do, of course,
against any country that simply refuses to follow their orders. It really is a case of geopolitical insubordination that is the origin of this entire sanctions policy.
Angelo Giuliano, are you noticing a trend over here when it comes to sanctions? I mean, we're looking at Venezuela, and it has one of the largest reserves of oil. We're looking at Iran, who's been a victim of sanctions in the most extreme way. Even the U.S. says it's one of the worst sanction regimes ever exercised on a country in the history of sanctions. We also can take a look at how Russia has been sanctioned. Are these countries that are rich with natural resources, lack oil, being targeted in any sense?
Of course. I mean, the main reason is because of oil. But from experience, we've seen that sanctions have never worked. On the contrary, what happens with sanctions is people, they look for different ways to bypass the sanctions, and especially when the sanctions are by using the dollar. When countries cannot trade in dollars, they are going to find other alternatives. And this is going to backfire for the United States, because we are seeing a trend of de-dollarization, meaning that the day that the world will de-dollarize, meaning that the US dollar will not have this hegemonic position, well, you could imagine a collapse of the US, because they are living on printing money and having a high standard, which is financed by the rest of the world. So these sanctions, we've seen all along. On the contrary, what has happened is that you can see a block, anti-US block being formed. You know, alliances that were unbelievable a long time ago, like Russia and China, now are among the strongest alliances. So basically, you could imagine a very strong block forming against the U.S.
Thank you so much for that. Angelo Giuliano, political analyst from Montreux. Thank you, Gerard Colmain, author and journalist there from Paris. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Well, the U.S. Senate is wrapping up the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, who is accused of inciting an insurrection on the Congress building last month. The upper chamber of Congress is on track to vote on whether to convict Trump. The former president's conviction is unlikely, as it would require at least 17 Republicans to vote alongside Democrats to find him guilty. Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the Senate, was quoted by the media as saying that he will vote against convicting Trump. The Democrats have warned that acquitting the former president would open the door for future presidents to violate their office during the final weeks of their presidency without suffering any accountability. The trial began 5 days ago with Democrats and Trump's lawyers laying out their arguments. And now to Thailand, where an anti-monarchy protesters have returned to the streets in the capital, clashing with riot police outside of the Grand Palace. Police say at least 15 officers were injured and 11 protesters arrested. Demonstrators demand the release of their leaders and the abolition of the Royal Defamation Law. Earlier in the day, protesters draped Bangkok's Democracy Monument in red cloth as a symbol of the blood of democracy fighters. Now, the protest movement kicked off last July but dwindled recently due to a fresh wave of coronavirus infections. Now, the recent detention of four of the movement's senior leaders reignited the protests. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Samer Arbit's case is just the latest example of Israeli regime forces going unpunished for vicious human rights abuses, says Tal Steiner, the executive director of the Public Committee Against Torture, in an article published under the heading "Torture of Palestinian Prisoners: Time to End Israeli Regime's Impunity." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. On September 25, 2019, a Palestinian man was arrested by Israeli regime troops and transferred to the compound detention facility in Al-Quds for interrogation by Israeli regime's internal intelligence agency, the Shin Bet. Samer Arbit's arrest marked the beginning of a wave of arrests in the ensuing months throughout the occupied West Bank. Later, media publications would describe this operation as a crackdown on the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. For 2 days after his arrest, Arbit, who had been otherwise healthy at the time of his arrest, was brought to Al-Quds Harassa Hospital in critical condition, suffering from kidney failure and broken ribs. He was placed on a respirator until his condition stabilized, and then, to the shame of the military court that approved it, sent back to the custody of the Shin Bet. What happened to Arbit between his arrest and his arrival at a hospital is an open secret. All signs indicate that he was tortured by Shin Bet agents. He and other suspects were reportedly forced into stress positions used routinely by Shin Bet agents, as documented in hundreds of testimonies gathered by the Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Palestine. One such position is the banana, in which the subject of interrogation is bent over a chair, hands and legs chained together underneath. Even a few minutes in this position can cause severe pain and suffering without leaving visible marks. But forensic medicine shows that kidney failure can be associated with the use of stress positions, where the strained muscles release acid into the bloodstream that the body cannot handle. The expectation was that when a person was brought to near death while in the hands of the Shin Bet, the Israeli regime system would jolt into action, investigate and press charges.
Otherwise, how could the Zionist regime maintain that torture was prohibited in the territory and that perpetrators would be held accountable? Indeed, the Israeli regime's attorney general ordered an investigation into the matter, but it concluded on January 24th with a decision to close the case in the absence of sufficient evidence to prove an offense. On the one hand, why should we be surprised by this, when according to data collected by the Public Committee Against Torture, of more than 1,300 complaints by interrogation subjects against Shin Bet agents, no charges were laid for torture or abuse. Only one even resulted in a criminal investigation, while the rest were dismissed after a preliminary examination. On the other hand, one cannot underestimate the gravity of this decision, where a person almost lost his life while in the custody of the Zionist regime authorities, but the people who brought him there received full impunity. Internally, the Attorney General's decision sends a message to all Israeli regime security agents that the system will back them, no matter how outrageous, brutal, and dangerous their actions. Indeed, Shin Bet's head, Nadav Agerman, later gave his full support to the interrogators, saying they carried out their mission professionally, in a statesmanlike manner, and according to law, and in their action saved the lives of many Israelis, he said. Internationally, the decision proves beyond a doubt that the Zionist regime lacks the ability or rather the motivation to meet its obligations under the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which aims to abolish torture and condemn those who commit it. It is time for both the Israeli regime and the international community to speak up against the Zionist regime's continued use of torture against Palestinians and others, along with the impunity given to perpetrators of this heinous crime. Torture is wrong and illegal under any circumstances.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Imam al-Baqir, salawatullahu salamuhu alayhi, is known. His name is actually Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Hussein. Yet he is known as Baqir, Baqir al-ilm ba'da al-nabi, or Baqir al-ilm al-nabiyyin, the one who split the seed of knowledge after the Prophet, or split the seed of the knowledge of prophets. He opened it up. During his time, because of the work, the efforts of the Ahlul Bayt, because of the efforts of Imam al-Husayn, because of the efforts of Imam Zainul Abidin, and the efforts of Imam al-Baqir, they reached a point where Imam al-Baqir was able to have sessions that multiple people attended from the Muslim community. And not only that, they started a whole movement reviving the sciences, the knowledge, the understanding, the teachings, the sunnah of the Prophet. In other words, there's a wrong perception, a wrong understanding that is there in regards to Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhima. We know, everybody knows, during that time, there's a lot of hadith. If you pick up books of hadith, most of the ahadith you're going to come across are either Qala al-Sadiq or Qala al-Baqir salamullah alayhima. So that means they had an opportunity where they were speaking more, and more people were writing down and listening to these imams. You will find their ahadith, at least as narrators of the hadith of the Holy Prophet, in books of those who didn't believe in those imams as being imams. You'll find it. They recorded their words, their sayings. Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Baqir, these two imams. So this is something that's pretty well known. The mistake that is made, the wrong understanding that needs to be corrected, is that the way it's said is this way, that Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq lived at a time that the Umayyads were weak and the Abbasids had not picked up, therefore they got an opportunity to express themselves. This is a common saying that we've heard. Even ulama mentioned this, non-ulama mentioned this, probably hearing it from ulama. It is clear to us that this is an inaccurate statement. What this suggests is that Imam Zain al-Abidin was just sitting there. He didn't get the opportunity, he didn't say anything, he didn't do anything. Imam al-Baqir suddenly came across an opportunity like, oh, we're able to speak, now we're going to go and speak. Imam al-Sadiq continued that, and then afterwards, Imam al-Kadhim had a difficult time right from the beginning, therefore he stopped speaking, so they went quiet again. The rest of the imams did not speak out. It was an opportunity that was created. They had nothing to do with it. They were not involved in it. And they simply took advantage of the circumstances that were there. That is an inaccurate statement. The accurate picture of that period is that Imam al-Husayn's revolution affected the Umayyads. Imam Zain al-Abidin continued with the revolution of Imam al-Husayn. They worked against the system. They started training people. Imam Zain al-Abidin did. He started this process with all the difficulties that were there. The movement of reviving the knowledge of the Prophet, the tafsir of the Quran, the sunnah of the Prophet, the sayings of the Prophet, because you know that was something that was banned. They weren't, and with the direction that the Umayyads especially now were taking, it should have come to a point where what you have of the Prophet is only nonsense, a whole bunch of fabrications, a wrong depiction of that Prophet. It's not about us as Shia having the book Wasa'il al-Shia today, or prior to that, Al-Kafi in Man La Yahduruhu Al-Faqih, or Tahdhib al-Ahkam, or Al-Istibsar, or the other books of hadith that we have. It's not about us having a Zurara as the student of Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhima, that gathered the sayings of Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Baqir. The movement of recording the sayings of the Prophet, finding whatever's out there, filtering it. That means he filtered, and that's what he says. If you look at the terminology of scholars, Sunni scholars, they say this hadith is sahih according to the criteria of Muslim, or the criteria of Bukhari. Based on their definition of what a sahih hadith is, this hadith is sahih, or that hadith is sahih, or this hadith is not. Who created this process in the Muslim Ummah for people to start studying what the Prophet has said, start filtering out Israiliyat, start filtering out what is not accurate? It's Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhim ajma'in. If you look at the students and those who were affected by this movement, there are multiple people that are affected by this movement. Some directly attending sessions, listening to Imam al-Baqir, or the students of Imam Zain al-Abidin. It started getting big. That wasn't there. There was another movement going on by the Umayyads. One that, especially after the Imams started this movement, the Umayyads tried to marginalize it, tried to hijack it, tried to deviate it. There's a student Imam Zain al-Abidin has, if I get his name fully accurately, Ibn Shihab al-Zuhri. Az-Zuhri is a student of Imam Zain al-Abidin. A student of Imam Zain al-Abidin, taught by Imam Zain al-Abidin, the Sunnah of the Prophet, Tafsir of the Quran, history, whatever, there's lots of stuff he learns. The Umayyads buy him. They employ him. Employ him to do what? To give out sayings of the Prophet, teachings of Islam, tafsir of the Quran, that would support the Umayyads. There's harsh words that Imam Zain al-Abidin has against Az-Zuhri after he went in that direction. The Imam started a movement to bring the Ummah back to the teachings of the Prophet. The Umayyads started a different one. Let me not sidetrack too much. There's a different things that happened there. The primary thing, the most important thing that I'm focusing on here is to suggest that it wasn't such that the Imam just found this opportunity. They were sitting back at home doing nothing and they're like, okay, now we can speak. They're not going to kill us. You go and speak. That's not what Imam al-Baqir did. That's not who he was. That's not Imam Zain al-Abidin. That's not Imam al-Sadiq. That's not any of the Imams. They created that opportunity by educating the masses, by getting the word of Allah out, explaining the verses of the Quran in so many different ways. Recite salawat, please. So, one of the things that we can take from this already up to this point is that the ability to get the word of Allah out, the tafsir of the Quran out, the sunnah of the Prophet out, was itself a struggle. Being able to express that was a struggle. Secondly, expressing the sunnah of the Prophet, explaining the tafsir of the Quran, was also a struggle itself. It was a jihad. Imam al-Baqir would speak and he would explain the Quran. This was a jihad. What does a jihad mean? It means that with those sessions, with the explanations of the Quran and the Sunnah, he is fighting the Umayyads.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. this program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Nikki Haley Slams Trump's Election Claims. We Shouldn't Have Followed Him. Stay with us for more of Jeremy Peters' article. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. Nikki Haley, a 49-year-old who is widely believed to be considering a run for president in 2024, told the website Politico she did not believe that the former president would remain a dominant force within the Republican Party, or that he would seek office again, arguing that he had lost any sort of political viability. "I don't think he's going to be in the picture," Ms. Haley said. "I don't think he can. He's fallen so far." Ms. Haley's comments predictably prompted a backlash from Donald Trump's loyal base of support, a constituency that most Republican officeholders continue to try to appease, and one that she had assiduously tried to avoid offending since leaving his administration at the end of 2018. Before her latest comments became public, Nikki Haley seemed to realize that they would go too far for many Republicans, and it was not long before she bowed to the reality of Mr. Trump's enduring power within the Republican Party. In an interview with Laura Ingraham of Fox News Channel that was broadcast late last month, after Ms. Haley had spoken to Politico but before the article was published, Ms. Haley muted her criticism of the former president considerably. "At some point, I mean, give the man a break," she said, condemning Democrats for pursuing a second impeachment against Donald Trump for instigating the 6th of January assault on the Capitol. "I mean, move on," she added. "Does he deserve to be impeached? Absolutely not." But the storming of the Capitol building last month and Donald Trump's role in inciting it with repeated false claims of ballot rigging in last November's election caused Ms. Haley to reassess her relationship with the former president. Her tone changed markedly between interviews with Politico in December and in January. At first, she refused to acknowledge that Mr. Trump was doing anything reckless by refusing to concede the election. She said that he genuinely believed he had not lost, and she would not acknowledge that his actions since the November election were irresponsible. And she wrongly predicted that Mr. Trump would go on his way once he had exhausted his legal options. But after the 6th of January riot, Nikki Haley told the publication that she had previously urged Mr. Trump to be more careful with his words, to no avail. "He went down a path he shouldn't have done," she said, referring to his deception about the election. "And we shouldn't have followed him, and we shouldn't have listened to him, and we can't let that ever happen again." In that moment, Nikki Haley's remarks showed that she was willing to entertain a political proposition that most other Republicans with eyes on the White House had not dared to utter publicly: that Donald Trump hold over the GOP base will loosen, and that he will not be the kingmaker that many have predicted. However calibrated or qualified, Nikki Haley's approach is a departure from that of other conservatives who are believed to harbor ambitions for higher office. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who lent credibility to Donald Trump's voter fraud claims, has refused to acknowledge that his own actions played any role in inciting violence on 6th of January. And former Vice President Mike Pence has said nothing publicly since being forced to flee the Senate chamber under armed guard as rioters stormed the Capitol building, encouraged in part by Donald Trump's attacks against the Vice President on Twitter for not interfering with the certification of the election. Nikki Haley was specially pointed about Donald Trump's treatment of Mike Pence, sounding almost dismissive of the former president as she expressed her dismay. "Mike Pence has been nothing but loyal to that man," she said. Some Republicans said that Ms. Haley's comments were simply acknowledging reality. As a politician who is more comfortable with the establishment wing of the GOP, she has not always had the trust of Donald Trump's base. And in a crowded 2024 presidential primary, she would face stiff competition from those votes. "You didn't have to be clairvoyant to see which way Nikki Haley would go once Donald Trump lost," said Sam Nunberg, a consultant who worked for Mr. Trump. she was never going to be able to take the Trump mantle. To other Republicans, her words of regret were too little too late, given her earlier deference towards Donald Trump. Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who has become one of the most outspoken critics of his party since the Capitol attack, accused Nikki Haley of playing both sides. On Twitter, he urged her to pick country first or Trump first. This is not Nikki Haley's first reversal on Donald Trump. Like many leaders of her party, she initially opposed him when he ran for the Republican nomination in 2016. At that time, she was the governor of South Carolina, and she endorsed Senator Marco Rubio of Florida ahead of her state's pivotal primary. Donald Trump still won, finishing ahead of Marco Rubio by 10 percentage points. But she redeemed herself in the eyes of many Republican voters by signing on to work in the Trump administration, showing how quickly old slights can be forgiven by the former president and his supporters.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The revolution came and brought full political independence for the country. That is to say, today in this vast world, there is not even a single power among the superpowers which can claim its will has the slightest effect on the will of the government officials or the Iranian nation. In particular, this issue, namely resistance, independence, political dignity, is the most attractive things for nations. When you notice that nations feel respect for the Iranian nation, you should pay attention to the fact that a major portion of this respect is related to our political independence. Monarchy was a system of government before the revolution. Democracy is the opposite of monarchy. In a monarchy, the people do not have any role in government. In a democracy, the people are in charge of everything.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 Allah.
Government was hereditary before the revolution. Rulers used to determine their successors before they died. That is to say, the people had no role in government. Whether they liked it or not, they had no choice but to accept their government. Thanks to the revolution, the people can now choose their government. The taste and will of the people play a determining role. Before the revolution, the system of government was security-based dictatorship. Harsh and dark dictatorship. I remember that a friend of mine came to Mashhad from Pakistan to see me. He had entered the country illegally. He said that once he was sitting in a park with his friends and that they were reading a political leaflet in the park. I was surprised. Reading a political leaflet in a park? Is such a thing possible? I could not imagine that somebody could walk in the street with a political leaflet in his pocket. A leaflet which contains a few criticisms of the government. This was how the security-based dictatorship of that time was like.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.